Chapter 9. Kompromat. The next spring, late in the evening on March 17, 1999, the nightly news program on the state television broadcast a report preceded by a warning that it might not be suitable for anyone under the age of 18. Excerpts of a black and white videotape appeared. It was clearly taken by a surveillance camera, secreted in position above a double bed in what turned out to be a Moscow apartment owned by a banker of some renown. Two young women, described as prostitutes, move in and out of the frame in various stages of undress. Soon, there appears a man who, as the announcer intoned, very much resembles the prosecutor general, Yuri Skuratov. The Kremlin's struggle with the prosecutor had intensified, and its counterattack had just taken a lurid turn. All the major networks had received cassette copies of the video earlier in the week from an anonymous source. It lasted 50 minutes in all. Only the state television channel, RTR, chose to use it, at least at first. The decision to do so was made, over the objection of some of the network's correspondents, by its general director, Mikhail Shvidkoy, who would later become Russia's Minister of Culture. The source and authenticity of the videotape remained murky, and the quality was poor enough that no one could say absolutely that it was Skuratov cavorting with the two women. Though, when one of them asks his name, having refused to give her own, he replied, Yura, the diminutive of Yuri. The videotape had all the characteristics of the honey traps the KGB once used to embarrass or blackmail businessmen or politicians. A joke soon circulated that the source of the video was a man who very much resembles the director of the FSB, Vladimir Putin. According to Yeltsin, it was his chief of administration, Nikolai Byardushka, who first obtained the videotape. Shocked, Byardushka confronted Skuratov privately at the Kremlin on February 1st, long before the scandal became public. Skuratov promptly wrote a letter of resignation, citing the deteriorating state of his health, and checked into a hospital the next day. Yeltsin had just been released from his own hospitalization, undergoing treatment this time for a bleeding ulcer. Byardushka himself checked into a hospital a month later. It was as if a plague were sweeping the country's political elite. On February 2nd, Yeltsin returned to his Kremlin office for the first time since the end of 1998. He stayed only for an hour and a half, but it was long enough to dismiss four aides and to accept Skuratov's resignation. The reason cited in the announcement was Skuratov's health, which, since the sudden illnesses of Soviet leaders, had long been a euphemism for deeper intrigues no one believed. Rumors of other dismissals, including Putin's, soon spread. No one knew what was unfolding behind the scenes. The upper house of parliament, the Federation Council, controlled by the country's governors, had the sole authority to confirm Skuratov's resignation. Already eyeing the power vacuum that would follow the imminent end of Yeltsin's term, the council refused to consider Skuratov's fate as long as he was in the hospital and unable to explain himself. Yeltsin claimed at the time that neither Byardushka nor his other aides had told him about the videotape before it became public. He was simply happy that Skuratov had resigned, and with ample reason. Skuratov had served as prosecutor general for more than 3 years, yet had distinguished himself only by a spectacular failure to solve the country's most notorious crimes, including the murder of Galina Starovoitova 2 months before. The endless monotone of Skuratov's excuses was beginning to annoy me, Yeltsin wrote. Skuratov, however, had not been completely idle. He showed more zeal investigating the president's affairs than the country's other notorious crimes, and in the months leading up to his dismissal, some of his investigations had suddenly gained new momentum. On the day in February that Byardushka confronted him with the videotape, Skuratov had delivered a report to the Duma accusing the Central Bank of Russia of secretly funneling $50 billion worth of foreign currency reserves through an obscure firm called Financial Management Company Limited. It was registered in 1990 in the Channel Islands, apparently by the KGB and the Communist Party, and used as an offshore account though many of the details remained unclear, including who might have profited from what were clearly illegal transfers. The next day, investigators from Skouratov's office, accompanied by masked special police officers, raided the Moscow headquarters of Sibneft, an oil company that was part of Boris Berezovsky's empire. A day after that, they showed up at Berezovsky's security firm, Atoll, where the investigators found electronic eavesdropping equipment and tapes labeled The Family, in reference to Yeltsin's inner circle of advisors, and Tanya, Yeltsin's younger daughter and political advisor, Tatiana Dyachenko. Despite his resignation, or possibly because of it, Skouratov's prosecutions suddenly shifted public attention and outrage over corruption to those at the heart of power in the Kremlin. After the wild abuses of privatization in the early 1990s, calls for justice grew louder, and sensing the political winds, the new prime minister, Yevgeny Primakov, announced at a cabinet meeting on January 28th that the government would amnesty 94,000 nonviolent prisoners in order to free up space for those who are about to be jailed, people who commit economic crimes. It sounded very much like a warning that even the oligarchs around the Kremlin could no longer count on immunity in the wake of a Yeltsin presidency. Berezovsky, whose intense dislike of Primakov was reciprocated, responded by declaring that Primakov's threat sounded like a return to the Great Terror. The raids on his companies followed not long afterward. Primakov's remarks had the rhetorical sweep of a politician ambitious to become Russia's next president. In his few months as prime minister, he had already built support in parliament and won over Moscow's powerful mayor, Yuri Lushkov, who had once been a friend of Yeltsin's, but now seemed to hover in wait for the president's demise. Yeltsin increasingly saw the political jockeying and Skouratov's investigations as an existential threat to his power and even his personal well-being. He mused on the internal Communist Party conspiracy that had toppled Nikita Khrushchev in 1964, and now he was sure Primakov and Lushkov were scheming with the prosecutor general to overthrow him. He had to do something to stop it. On the day the Federation Council finally took up the question of his resignation, March 17th, Skouratov appeared to be in good health and now asked to keep his job, if you extend your trust and support to me. He explained to the lawmakers that he had resigned only under duress, and he blamed it on two former prime ministers and well-known oligarchs. He did not mention Berezovsky, but he did discuss the raids investigators had launched against Berezovsky's companies. These people were aware of my resignation no less than 2 weeks in advance, he said. He referred obliquely to people collecting information about his private life, but now seemed determined to hold on to his job. It was then that the Kremlin sent the videotape of Skouratov and the women to members of the Federation Council, who were preparing to vote on Skouratov's fate. The tactic backfired badly. The council's members were shocked and appalled, not by the videotape itself, but by the use of such a crude trick to influence the outcome of its deliberations. They voted 142-6 to reject Skouratov's resignation and leave him in office. The videotape promptly aired a few hours after the council's vote. In the ensuing public uproar, it was impossible to say which was more morally compromising, the behavior on the bed, or the decision to make it public. The next morning, Yeltsin summoned Skouratov to the hospital room where he was recovering, again from a bleeding ulcer. By then, Yeltsin too had a copy, as well as still photographs. When Skouratov arrived, he found Primakov and Putin waiting in the room as well. He was not surprised by Putin's presence. Putin had visited him while he was hospitalized, told him that the family had been satisfied with his quiet departure in February, and offered to make him the ambassador to Finland, an honorable exile. Skouratov had refused. "Then what would you like to be?" Putin asked. Skouratov told him he wanted to continue the very work I have performed. After Skouratov's release from the hospital in February, Putin tried new tactics to persuade him to resign. He called once and told the prosecutor he empathized with his quandary. He confided that they say there was a similar videotape of Putin himself. Perhaps it would be best to avoid scandal by stepping aside. Putin visited Skuratov again at his government house in Arkhangelskaya. They were neighbors, and as they strolled in the wooded grounds, he worked him like a source or a recruit, alternately confiding and threatening. "Yuri Ilyich," he began respectfully, "I am amazed that you managed to work 3.5 years in this cesspool." He said he could not imagine surviving in his job until the end of Yeltsin's term. Then Putin's tone shifted abruptly. He pulled out a sheaf of papers and said there were irregularities in the renovation of Skuratov's apartment in Moscow. He insinuated that Skuratov was under fire now because of his investigation into Putin's former boss, Pavel Borodin. Through it all, Skuratov thought, Putin had been unfailingly polite. But the allusion to Borodin confirmed in his mind that his investigations had indeed struck close to Yeltsin and the family. Borodin's contracts with Mercada, the company that had renovated the Kremlin in 1994, and its sister company, Mabutex, had also come under the scrutiny of investigators abroad. There were suspicious transactions that suggested money laundering. In January, only weeks before the videotape appeared, investigators in Switzerland had raided Mabutex's offices in Lugano and confiscated records that appeared to show that the company had not only paid bribes to Russian officials to win construction projects, but also paid off the balances of credit cards belonging to Yeltsin's daughters. Switzerland's chief prosecutor, Carla Del Ponte, had launched a prosecutorial campaign against the laundering of criminal profits in Switzerland, complaining the country was threatened by dirty Russian money, and the evidence against Mabutex surfaced as a result. Even as the Skuratov scandal was unfolding in March, she traveled to Moscow to pursue her investigation, offering to share the Swiss evidence in exchange for Russian cooperation. In 2 days of private meetings, she and Skuratov discussed the investigations, including, he claimed, details of bank accounts belonging to several Kremlin officials. Now that the Kremlin was trying to force him to resign, Skuratov had the leverage to fight back, confident that the Federation Council would side with him in the power struggle of Yeltsin's political twilight. When Yeltsin confronted Skuratov at the hospital the morning after the Federation Council's first vote, the morning after the videotape aired, he tapped his fingers on a copy of the videocassette. "You know, Yuri Ilyich," Yeltsin told him, leaning back in his chair and breathing deep, "I have never cheated on my wife." Yeltsin then promised to stop showing it on television if Skuratov would write a second letter of resignation. This was elementary blackmail, Skuratov thought, but he also knew that it was pointless to debate its authenticity now. Skuratov protested that he had launched an investigation into Mabutex, which Yeltsin interpreted as a form of blackmail in return. "We're talking about something else now, Yuri Ilyich," Yeltsin told him. "After what's happened to you, I don't think you should remain in the post of prosecutor general. I won't fight with you. I won't try to persuade you. Just write your resignation letter. I will no longer work with you." Yeltsin pushed a pen and paper toward him. Skuratov turned to Primakov, expecting support from the prime minister who had pledged to fight corruption among the country's oligarchs. He received none. Putin said nothing, though Skuratov sensed him observing him throughout. Skuratov signed the letter, resigning for the second time in less than 7 weeks, though Yeltsin agreed to his request that the letter be postdated until April and the next scheduled meeting of the Federation Council. As Skuratov left the hospital and returned to his office, he contemplated his next move. He envisioned his fight with the Kremlin as a game of chess. His position was tenuous, but he had just avoided checkmate. Now he must counterattack. While driving, he called a television reporter and made the Mabutex investigation public. Of all the political controversies surrounding Yeltsin's presidency, The investigation that Skuratov and the Swiss had launched into Mercata and Mabutex posed the direst threat yet to the president and his family. Yeltsin himself acknowledged that this was the one scandal that had legs and could even bring his presidency to a premature end. The day after his confrontation with Skuratov, Yeltsin checked out of the hospital and returned briefly to the Kremlin. He fired his chief of staff, Nikolai Byarduzha, with no public explanation, though many later assumed it was because of his failure to remove Skuratov quietly. Byarduzha, a former military officer, received an honorable exile, like the one Putin had offered to Skuratov, becoming the ambassador to Denmark. Yeltsin replaced him with Alexander Voloshin, a former business partner of Boris Berezovsky. 10 days later, he promoted Putin to Secretary of the Security Council. It was then that Putin intervened in a way that would deepen Yeltsin's trust in him. Although Putin denied that his agency recorded Skuratov's tryst, he did make it clear that the FSB had intimate knowledge of its provenance. On April 2nd, he announced that the videotape was in fact genuine, first to the Federation Council, with eyes downcast, as Skuratov described it, and then again in remarks to waiting reporters. As embarrassing as that was, it was not enough by itself to force Skuratov, but Putin had found a legal technicality that trumped the council's obstinacy. He went on to announce that there had been other parties, like the one in the video, and that they had been paid for by criminals trying to influence Skuratov's investigations. If shown true, this would be a grave crime, and since any civil servant under criminal investigation had to step down pending the resolution of the charges, Putin's announcement did what nothing else had so far. In the middle of the night, the Kremlin called in a deputy prosecutor in Moscow, presented him with the FSB's evidence, and ordered him to open an investigation. Now, Skuratov had no choice but to step aside until this new case against him was resolved. Yeltsin then announced that he had suspended Skuratov. He removed his personal security detail, cut his office phone lines, and ordered his office sealed. Russia, without a prosecutor general, was the lesser of two evils, Yeltsin would write. Putin's maneuver was technically legal, assuming there was some basis to the accusations of influence buying, but it was also ruthless. A grateful Yeltsin once again took note. A week later, he announced that Putin would remain director of the FSB, even as he presided over the Security Council. He had demonstrated his loyalty to the president, impressing him with his quiet efficiency. Others might promise, but Putin achieved results. After only 2.5 years in Moscow, Putin now stood at the center of Yeltsin's administration, no longer a mere deputy, but one of the most powerful officials in the Kremlin. Putin rose through the ranks as the Yeltsin era seemed to be in its death throes. The unfolding Skuratov scandal aided efforts by the communists to impeach Yeltsin, a step that would have made Primakov acting president until new elections could be held. The president, ailing and fearful, no longer exerted much control over events, but instead reacted to them, often erratically. On March 5, 1999, the Interior Ministry's special envoy to Chechnya, General Gennady Shpigun, was kidnapped as he boarded a plane in the region's capital, Grozny. Kidnappings had become the principal post-war industry in Chechnya, with hundreds of people held for ransom between 1996 and 1999. But the abduction of a senior envoy was too brazen for the Kremlin to ignore. The peace talks that ended the war in 1996 had given Chechnya a great deal of sovereignty, but nearly 2 years of fighting had devastated the region and left its economy in ruins. The war had killed as many as 100,000 Chechens, as well as nearly 5,000 Russian soldiers, according to official records that some doubted were complete. Having survived the Russian counterassault, Chechnya after the war descended into chaos and criminality, undermining efforts by the region's elected president, Aslan Maskhadov, to restore order and win international recognition for its secession from Russia. Soon, the lawlessness was spilling over Chechnya's borders. On March 19th, the day after Skuratov's second resignation, an enormous bomb exploded in a market in the southern city of Vladikavkaz, the capital of North Ossetia, another of the republics along the Caucasus, not far from Grozny. The blast killed more than 60 people. Yeltsin ordered Putin and the interior minister, Sergei Stepashin, to Vladikavkaz to oversee the investigation. 2 days later, Maschadov narrowly survived an assassination attempt. A former artillery officer from the Soviet era, Maschadov was a committed nationalist and separatist, but he was one of the few Chechen leaders the Kremlin could negotiate with. For much of the year, planning had been underway for Maschadov to meet with Primakov or even Yeltsin himself to finalize Chechnya's transition to independence, as allowed in the peace accords of 1996. Now, Maschadov suggested that certain forces in Moscow had conspired to kill him as a pretext for declaring a state of emergency and avoiding a resolution of Chechnya's fate. Putin angrily denounced the accusation. The peace accords that had suspended the first war had been a humiliation to Russia. They now no longer offered much hope for resolving the republic's ultimate drive for independence. The Kremlin's security men, including Putin, began drafting plans for a new war instead. The renewed turmoil in Chechnya unfolded as Russia was facing a war waged by the Soviet Union's archenemy, NATO, against the country's Slavic brothers in Serbia. After the breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s, Serbia turned its nativist fury on the once autonomous Muslim region within its own borders, Kosovo. At the end of 1998, Serbia's president, Slobodan Milosevic, launched a campaign to crush separatist militias in the region. Within months, the campaign looked more and more like the ethnic cleansing that had occurred in Bosnia only a few years before. Europe and the United States, shamed by their dithering over the earlier killing, responded aggressively. The prospect of a NATO military intervention to protect Kosovo infuriated Russia in ways American and European leaders failed to appreciate. Serbia and Russia shared Slavic roots, religion, and culture, but Russia's concerns went deeper. The conflict in Serbia inflamed Russia's wounded pride over its deflated status since the collapse of the Soviet Union. The new Russia lacked the ability to shape world events, which made the American-led actions even harder to swallow. Yeltsin berated President Clinton, insisting that an intervention was forbidden by international law, only to be ignored. Russia resented the fact that the United States and its expanding NATO alliance were acting as if they could impose their will on the new world order without regard to Russia's interests. Even worse, the conflict in Kosovo had striking parallels to the one in Chechnya, and even Russians not prone to paranoia could imagine a NATO campaign on behalf of Chechnya's independence movement. NATO's air war, which began on March 24, 1999, lasted 78 days, and each bomb or missile that fell on Serbia was perceived as an attack on Russia itself. Popular sentiment raged, with violent protests outside the American embassy and virulent denunciations in the Duma. The war stoked the nationalistic sentiment that Yeltsin had endlessly struggled to contain for his own political survival. He dispatched his former prime minister, Viktor Chernomyrdin, to act as a mediator with the United States and NATO. He did so at the suggestion of Putin, who considered it his own small contribution to resolving the war. After weeks of relentless bombardment, Milosevic had finally given in to NATO's demands and agreed to withdraw Serbia's forces from Kosovo to make way for an international peacekeeping force. Now Russia demanded to be part of the force, but refused to be in any way under the command of NATO's generals. Putin, newly appointed as the head of the Security Council, took part in negotiations to resolve the impasse over the peacekeeping mission. I was struck by his ability to convey self-control and confidence in a low-key, soft-spoken manner, Strobe Talbot, then the Deputy Secretary of State, wrote of his first meeting with Putin on June 11th, the day before NATO's peacekeepers were to move into Kosovo from Albania and Macedonia. He was physically the smaller of the men at the top, short, lean, and fit, while all the others were taller and most of them were hefty and overfed. Putin had prepared for his meeting with the American, referencing details of the poets Talbot had studied as a student, Fyodor Tchouchev and Vladimir Mayakovsky. He had clearly read Talbot's intelligence profile. During the meeting, the Americans received a note that Russia was threatening to send its peacekeepers into Kosovo without NATO coordination. Putin soothingly told Talbot that nothing had changed in the agreements they had reached and that nothing improper would happen. Something did, anyway, and Talbot came to believe that Putin had known all along that it would. That evening, a Russian paratroop unit stationed in Bosnia, part of an earlier, now seemingly naive sign of post-Soviet cooperation with NATO, loaded up and drove from its base to the airport in Kosovo's capital, Pristina. When British troops arrived at the airport on the morning of June 12th in a heavy downpour, roughly 200 Russians were already there in armored vehicles. As General Michael Jackson, the newly appointed British commander of the peacekeeping effort, landed there and prepared to announce the successful launch of the mission, one of the Russian vehicles rumbled through his impromptu tarmac news conference. A Russian squad commander stood halfway out of the turret with a discernible smirk on his face. NATO's supreme commander, General Wesley Clark, implored Jackson to somehow block the Russian deployment, but Jackson refused. "Sir," Jackson told Clark, "I'm not starting World War III for you." In Russia, the reaction to the deployment was ebullient, but the improvised intervention at the airport nonetheless showed the disarray of the country's civilian and military commands. Putin, who a day before had said nothing would happen, acted as if nothing had when Talbot met him again the next day. He claimed total ignorance of the military's preemptive rush into Pristina, but explained, slowly, calmly, in a voice that was sometimes inaudible, that the country's pre-election struggle had pitted the hawks and doves against one another. Putin suggested it had been a mistake, but nonetheless, the operation boosted the president at home. "No one in Russia," Putin told Talbot, "should be able to call President Yeltsin a puppet of NATO." Putin's remarks about the pre-election struggle underscored the extent to which the end of Yeltsin's presidency had become an overriding obsession of Russia's political elite. The country, after centuries of czarist and then communist rule, had never democratically transferred political power from one leader to another. The personification of power ran so deep in Russian culture that it seemed inconceivable. Even at this late stage, Yeltsin toyed with the idea of running for re-election. Though he had been elected twice already, the country's new constitution, which limited a president to two consecutive terms, had taken effect only in 1993. He could argue that legally his re-election in 1996 began his first term, allowing him to run again in 2000, but all that was fantastical. He was already 68, frail, and politically crippled. He had not yet resigned himself to leaving the Kremlin, but he knew it was inevitable. He thought hard about how to ensure a transition that would both preserve the political transition from Soviet rule and protect himself from the vengeful purges that had followed the removal of every leader since the Romanovs. Retirement had never been kind to the country's leaders. In the midst of the Kosovo conflict, Yeltsin had moved decisively to lay the groundwork for his life after the presidency. In May, he sacked his fourth prime minister. Primakov had proved a stabilizing force during his 8 months in office, calming the panic of the August default in 1998 and navigating the parliamentary impeachment proceedings. He had been nothing but honest and decent and loyal, Yeltsin admitted. His greatest failure as prime minister had been to become more popular than Yeltsin. Now, a year before the 2000 presidential elections, Primakov and Moscow's mayor, Yuri Lushkov, were the presumed frontrunners to take over the country. and that was something Yeltsin could not accept. He was concerned by Primakov's remarks about freeing up prison space for economic criminals, and by the fact that the Duma had completed 5 articles of impeachment and scheduled a debate for May. If any one article passed, Yeltsin would lose his authority to dissolve parliament for as long as the impeachment proceedings moved ahead. Even if he could successfully delay or defeat impeachment, he would lose the leverage that had allowed him to push Kiryenko through as prime minister the year before. Primakov could remain as prime minister and continue to amass political allies. Yeltsin, searching for an heir, thought Primakov did not have the temperament to be president. Russia needed a person of a completely different mindset, another generation, a new mentality. Primakov, he believed, had too much red in his political palette. Without question, the impeachment proceedings were politically motivated, pressed by the communists and their allies in what was, arguably, the last great political battle over the collapse of the Soviet Union. Yeltsin's crimes, according to the articles, began with the agreement that dissolved the Soviet Union in 1991. They went on to include the violent confrontation with the parliament in 1993, the war in Chechnya, the erosion of the military, and the genocide of the Russian people caused by the economic crises of the 1990s. As matters of constitutional law, they were dubious, but they resonated deeply with a frustrated public, for whom the end of the Soviet Union had brought little but suffering and shame. Yeltsin's impeachment became a referendum on Russia's transition to democracy, and each article had the support of a majority of lawmakers. On May 12th, the day before the impeachment debate began, Yeltsin dismissed Primakov and nominated Sergei Stepashin, a loyal, if colorless, police commander who had served in various ministries under Yeltsin since 1990, most recently as Interior Minister. He had been appointed a deputy prime minister only 2 weeks before, the post being a prerequisite for anyone appointed acting prime minister, and during a government meeting, Yeltsin made an embarrassing show of ordering Stepashin to move his chair closer to his own in order to, as he put it, whip up the sense of expectation. Yeltsin treated these shakeups as tactics in a game, and in truth, they were all the power he had left to influence politics. A sharp, unexpected, aggressive move always throws your opponent off balance and disarms him, especially if it is unpredictable and seems absolutely illogical, Yeltsin wrote. He hoped that this latest reorganization could somehow derail the impeachment vote, but absolutely illogical is all it seemed to be. The impeachment debate lasted 2 days, while Yeltsin's aides frantically tried to count and buy votes. When the votes were held, 94 of the 450 deputies failed to show up, making it more difficult to reach the 300 votes required to adopt each article of impeachment. Even so, 283 of those present voted to impeach Yeltsin for the war in Chechnya, which liberals had opposed with almost as much passion as Yeltsin's conservative opponents. 263 voted for the article pertaining to the events of October 1993. The other articles lagged, but all received an overwhelming majority of those present, and only narrowly failed to impeach him. Yeltsin's gambit with Stepashin had not affected the outcome of the debate as much as he thought it might, but when the dust settled, on May 19th, the Duma voted, surprisingly and overwhelmingly, to accept Stepashin's nomination as prime minister. The deputies calculated that he would be nothing more than a caretaker prime minister under a fatally wounded president until parliamentary elections were held in December. And if the prime minister's job was a springboard to the presidency in 2000, they had little to fear from this meek, apolitical administrator. Yeltsin's endorsement was a kiss of death anyway, and Yeltsin seemed to know that. He later claimed he had low expectations from Stepashin, and he had one last gambit to unveil. He wanted to wait until the time was right. On the day of Stepashin's appointment, Putin met with Yeltsin in the Kremlin and presented a plan to increase the FSB's authority across the Northern Caucasus. The plan meant to improve the coordination and means which are available to the federal organs of power. In short, to prepare for war in a region that was careering out of control, not only in Chechnya, where Moscow effectively had no authority, but also in the neighboring republics, like Karachayeva Chakhesia, where local elections in May threatened to provoke a bloodbath between rival ethnic groups. Putin had had no experience dealing with the Caucasus before he moved to Moscow and dealt with the region's problems first as the inspector for the main control directorate, and then as the director of the FSB. Since Catherine the Great's conquests, the mostly Muslim land stretching from the Black Sea to the Caspian had been restive subjects of the Russian and later the Soviet empires. Stalin expelled entire Caucasian populations to Siberia during the Great Patriotic War, fearing they would embrace the Nazi invaders. The collapse of the Soviet Union unleashed old grievances, which culminated in Chechnya's Declaration of Independence and the disastrous war from 1994 to 1996. In Putin's mind, this amounted to the dismemberment of Russia itself, aided and abetted by nefarious foreign influences. Apparently, he meant the victors of the Cold War, principally the United States. The debacle of Kosovo and the near clash at the airport prompted Yeltsin to order the Security Council to meet weekly to better coordinate national security strategy. The meetings further raised Putin's public profile. He began granting regular interviews to newspapers and television channels, answering the questions of the day, from a new nuclear doctrine to American complaints about Russian espionage, from a proposed reunification of Russia and Belarus to the coming political campaign. Yeltsin's continued infirmity fueled rumors of unrest and even of a coup by hardliners. In an interview with Komsomolskaya Pravda, Putin deflected a question about the possibility of a coup by the security services with a sardonic aside. "Why should we stage a coup if we are in power as it is?" he asked. His comments sent chills through the country's liberals and Yeltsin's opponents, who did not take the threat so lightly. By the end of July, Yeltsin cut short a vacation and returned to the Kremlin. He complained that a heat wave had made vacationing impossible, but he had a more pressing matter that for the time being only he knew. The precipitating cause was an election alliance revealed the day before between his banished Prime Minister, Yevgeny Primakov, and Mayor Lushkov of Moscow. No longer close to Yeltsin, Lushkov was now unleashing virulent attacks on the president's administration and his ties to the oligarchs. The media, including newspapers and a television station funded by Lushkov's government, published report after report on Yeltsin's family and the corruption around it. Yeltsin complained that the most slanderous stories had been bought by or leaked to the same newspapers the KGB had used in Soviet times, even though his man Putin was in charge of its successor. NTV, which had once supported Yeltsin against the communist threat, turned against him with a vengeance after his chief of staff, Alexander Voloshin, tried to stop government loans to its owner, MediaMost, the holding company of Vladimir Guzinski, one of the oligarchs who had bankrolled Yeltsin's 1996 re-election effort. Yeltsin convinced himself that the Primakov-Lushkov juggernaut was a plot not simply to win the parliamentary elections, but to abolish the presidency itself. In several meetings over the summer, he pleaded with Stepashin to do something, anything, to stop governor after governor from pledging support to Lushkov's party, called the Fatherland, which was now allied with Primakov's all-Russia bloc. Yeltsin brooded, increasingly isolated from all but his inner circle, the family that was now in as precarious a position as ever. He was simply unable to understand what was going on in Russia, a Russian historian, Roy Medvedev, wrote, and was thinking not so much about holding on to power, but guaranteeing his own personal security. 8 years after his heroic resistance to the putsch, Yeltsin had lost the admiration of a nation that was breaking free after decades of Soviet ideology. His memoirs did nothing to hide the self-pitying state he had reached. He felt abandoned, distrustful, and almost certainly afraid. "I tortured myself with worries. Who would support me? Who was really backing me?" Yeltsin claimed he had decided on his next course of action months before, though given his reactive and improvisational leadership, that seems doubtful. Even if he had thought of it earlier, no one else knew what he had decided to do, not even his closest advisors, until the announcement was imminent. It certainly seemed impetuous, not planned. On August 5th, he summoned Putin to his dacha outside Moscow for a secret meeting. "I've made a decision, Vladimir Vladimirovich," Yeltsin told him, "and I would like to offer you the post of Prime Minister." Putin said nothing at first. He simply stared attentively at Yeltsin, digesting the news. Yeltsin explained the state of affairs, the brewing trouble in the Caucasus, the economy and inflation, and the thing that obsessed him most, the Kremlin's need to manufacture a parliamentary majority in elections that were now just 4 short months away. Putin, he believed, would act where Stepashin had dithered on the most existential issue facing the Kremlin, Yeltsin's fate in the event Lushkov or Primakov became the next president. Putin had already shown that he would act. As Lushkov's political momentum built in the spring, Putin had launched an investigation into the company controlled by his wife, Yelena Baturina. Her company, Inteco, had managed to win contract after contract, making her the first woman billionaire in Russia, a rags-to-riches tale that helped leave the millions of Russians impoverished by the collapse of the Soviet Union deeply embittered about this new capitalism and democracy, and not a little bit envious. Lushkov bellowed in protest when investigators began pouring through Baturina's finances. He was no longer afraid to challenge Yeltsin and his senior security advisor. "The FSB," Lushkov protested, "unfortunately works for the Kremlin today, not for the country." Yeltsin was now asking Putin to take on a far more important role. He was asking him to build and lead a political party that could defeat those who had almost completely abandoned the president. When he finally spoke, Putin asked the obvious question: "How can you build a parliamentary majority with no supporters in parliament?" "I don't know," Yeltsin replied. Putin reflected for an unusually long time in silence. His quiet demeanor had attracted Yeltsin, but now it seemed like hesitation. "I don't like election campaigns," he finally said. "I really don't. I don't know how to run them, and I don't like them." Yeltsin assured him that he would not have to run the campaign himself. Campaign tactics were the least of his worries. Experts could master political technologies. He must simply project what now eluded Yeltsin: confidence, authority, the military bearing he believed the country craved. In his desperation, the latter was very much on Yeltsin's mind. Putin replied with military terseness, he recalled. "I will work where you assign me." Yeltsin's next remark nonetheless surprised him. "And in the highest post?" For the first time, Yeltsin said, Putin seemed to comprehend the full intent of his plan. He was not being offered a sacrificial position like the previous three prime ministers who lasted only months in the office. Yeltsin was suggesting him as his heir as president, an endorsement that had eluded so many of Yeltsin's senior aides. A silence fell between the two men. Yeltsin felt the tick of the clock in his office. He found himself contemplating Putin's blue eyes. "They seem to speak more than his words," he thought. He asked him to think about it, and then summoned Stepashin, who took the news of his dismissal as prime minister badly, pleading with Yeltsin to reconsider. Yeltsin, who preferred the quick execution of his decisions, uncharacteristically sympathized with his prime minister, who had been loyal to him throughout his presidency. Yeltsin agreed to think about it, a forbearance he immediately regretted. Anatoly Chubais, who had first worked with Putin in 1991, tried to talk Yeltsin out of his decision to appoint Putin as prime minister, appealing to the chief of staff, Alexander Voloshin, and to Yeltsin's daughter. Chubais had always been cool to Putin, regarding him as a security man with little political savvy and, rightly, no political experience. Chubais had left Yeltsin's administration for a final time and by then headed the state electricity monopoly. But he had masterminded Yeltsin's comeback in 1996, and his political instincts were surer than Yeltsin's at this point. There was little obvious advantage to replacing Stepashin with Putin. Neither had ever been elected to anything. They were the same age, both came from Petersburg, and neither had any independent political base that would shore up Yeltsin. Chubais warned him that another reshuffling of his government would be seen as yet another act of madness that would bolster the communists and the emerging alliance between Lushkov and Primakov. Even as Chubais was pleading his case, however, events in the Caucasus hardened Yeltsin's resolve. On August 7th, a large force of Chechen fighters crossed the republic's border and encircled three towns in the neighboring Republic of Dagestan. Russia's military and interior police had prepared for months for an incursion, but the Chechen forces again acted with impunity in the rugged borderland. They were commanded by two fighters, Shamil Basayev, a ferocious rebel commander, and a shadowy figure with the nom de guerre Khattab. Khattab, a Saudi, was a veteran of Islamic insurgencies dating back to the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. He was a conduit for the foreign influence that Putin had warned about. Stepashin, whose handling of a similar intrusion in 1995 had led to his dismissal as the head of the FSB, flew to Dagestan the next day with the military's chief of staff, General Anatoly Kwashnin, to oversee what turned into a full battle between the Chechen fighters and Russian troops. Stepashin declared that there would be no repetition of the mistakes of the Chechen War, and Russian artillery and rockets began hammering the villages occupied by the Chechen forces. When Stepashin flew back to Moscow the next day, Yeltsin went ahead with his plans and fired him, nominating Putin as the next prime minister. "I have now decided to name a person who, in my opinion, can bring society together," Yeltsin said in a television speech on August 9th. "Relying on the broadest political powers, he will ensure the continuation of reforms in Russia." Yeltsin did not explicitly name Putin as his anointed heir, but he did mention the election scheduled for June 2000, expressing hope the voters would also find confidence in this diminutive, still relatively untested leader. "I think that he has enough time to show his worth." "This is the kiss of death," a prominent communist strategist, Leonid Dobrokhotov, declared at the time, referring to Yeltsin's endorsement. Given the universal loathing of him in the country, any recommendation by him of any politician, even the best, points the way to the grave. The Duma's speaker, Gennady Selezniov, also declared that Yeltsin had ended Putin's political career, saying that deputies should not waste weeks debating the nomination, since he could be fired in the next 3 months. Even Putin himself doubted his future as a political leader, a future he had not considered for himself, as anyone who knew him well understood. It had already been a difficult summer for Putin. His father's health had deteriorated badly, and despite his ever-increasing responsibilities at the FSB and Security Council, Putin traveled to Petersburg at least once a week to see him. His mother, Maria, had died the year before. Both had lived long enough to see him rise through the ranks of the city and federal governments that emerged out of the ruins of the Soviet Union. Putin's relationship with his father had never been close, but the taciturn old veteran's pride was palpable. On his deathbed, he exclaimed, "My son is like a czar." He died on August 2nd, and Putin had just returned from the funeral in Petersburg when Yeltsin offered him the post of prime minister. Putin knew despite what Yeltsin would later claim, that the president might discard him as quickly as he had discarded Stepashin, Primakov, and Kirienko. He calculated he had 2, 3, maybe 4 months before he too would be dismissed. Now, at the age of 46, he felt he had been given his historical mission, and only a short time to complete it. The violence on Chechnya's border with Dagestan seemed like a continuation of the dissolution that had begun in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. The war in Chechnya had been a humiliation. Russia's leaders had reacted timidly to what was an existential threat to the nation. He felt the country was coming apart as Yugoslavia had and as East Germany had. "If we don't put an immediate end to this, Russia will cease to exist," he recalled thinking. The war in Chechnya had been profoundly unpopular, dragging down Yeltsin's reputation and prompting a vote on his impeachment. He knew a new conflict would be risky, too. "I realized I could only do this at the cost of my political career," he said. "It was a minimal cost, and I was prepared to pay up." He recalled being a tiny kid in the courtyard who the bullies were sure was going to get his butt kicked. Not this time. In the Caucasus, he was going to bang the hell out of those bandits.